My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of talking to Mary Doria Russell. Mary, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
We were talking before we went on. It's been 10 years since you've been here.
It has, yeah. In the meantime, it wasn't that I didn't write anything. I mean, I wrote a giant book called A Thread of Grace during that time. But
And I'm sorry to say I didn't get a chance to read it, but you're here now for a book entitled Dreamers of the Day, and it's published by Random House. And, you know, when I read this book, I said to myself, most novels, you don't really need to know why the novel was written. I mean, they're fairly self-contained. They tell a story. You can see what the author had in mind right from the get-go. But this, I mean, you always write novels of ideas. Whatever else you're writing in the book, there's always ideas to bounce around inside your head. Was there any particular thing that motivated you to write this book?
The book itself, I have come to think of as the archaeology of our present political moment. There is a straight line between the 1921 Cairo Peace Conference and the fact that I'm wearing my
nephew
Tim's dog tags. He's a Marine First Lieutenant stationed in Al Anbar Province. And between 1921 and Timmy being right there, there is a direct line.
I can only say the best and Mazel Tov and all
you.
That stuff.
Thank
yeah.
you. Yeah, we're real proud of him, and we're real not happy about why he's there.
Mm-hmm.
What got this started was that in 2001, when Osama bin Laden took credit for the attacks of 9/11, in his statement he mentioned that it was in part revenge for the catastrophe of 80 years ago. And I remember hearing that phrase go by and thinking to myself, well, World War I ended in 1918, and the Versailles Peace Conference was 1919, and I couldn't come up with anything significant that happened in 1921. Clearly, Osama bin Laden was still pretty ripped about it.
Yeah, they call us crusaders.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know, they have a long memory.
Yeah, exactly. And so it sat in the back of my mind. I was still writing A Thread of Grace at that point. That was a massive seven-year effort to get everything right about that book. But I finished that book, sent in the manuscript to Random House, and I was going to take a year off. I was going to read for pleasure and rest up because it had been a very tough 7 years. And I was watching the History Channel, and I saw this special, or was a documentary on T.E. Lawrence. And Lawrence was, you know, I saw the movie Lawrence of Arabia in 1962 when it first came out. And there were a lot of us boomers who were young teenagers at that time. And we were enormously affected by that movie. And I'm not quite sure why. And I wish some psychologist would.
I couldn't look at sand for about 2 years after that.
But I do think that Lawrence became a sort of third parent. I mean, that's how significant he was in my life. My mom was steel, my dad was heart, and Lawrence was scholarship. And that was something that nobody else in my family was bringing to the table.
So you ran out and bought Seven Pillars of Wisdom and read that immediately?
I bought Seven Pillars of Wisdom. I read all the biographies. I became, I got involved with archaeology, decided I would rather work indoors. you know, archaeologists got to be out in the sand and stuff. I don't do that.
Heat and bugs. And
heat and bugs. I want to be with the material after it's been brought back to the museum and it just needs to be analyzed. So I ended up as a biological anthropologist. But all of these things got started because of this initial interest in Lawrence. And I'm watching this thing and I thought, oh my God, I've got a decade on Lawrence. Because the last time I'd really thought about him, I was a teenager. And I remember thinking, oh, well, he died at 46, so at least he wasn't young.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, which at this point, I thought, oh, my God, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
So I suddenly realized I was a decade older than he ever got to be, and I decided that I would go upstairs and get out one of the biographies and see how I reacted to him as an adult, you know, after another 40 years to mature and experience and see what I thought. And in the third chapter of this biography, I came across this reference to the 1921 Cairo Peace Conference. And then I did the math.
Mm-hmm.
That's the catastrophe of 80 years ago for the Arab world. It's something that we don't remember at all, and that is still a live issue in the Middle East. That was the place where Lady Gertrude Bell drew a line around Mosul and Baghdad and Basra and called everything inside it Iraq.
Where'd you come up with the name?
It means something, and I,
Was it just like she threw her Scrabble set in the air?
No. Yeah, I have a cue, and don't have a U, so we're just going to call it a rack with no cue. I can't remember why they came up with that name. It means something in Arabic that was appropriate at the time. It was called Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
It was called Mesopotamia until that time. And at the conference, it was pointed out rather forcefully by Arnold Wilson to her that you can't put a line around Kurds, Sunni, and Shia and expect them to be able to get along with one another. These are not ethnic groups that have any common history that they want to share. And that was completely overlooked. And Winston Churchill decided that Gertrude Bell's idea was really good because it meant that they could administer this state, this protectorate, with one colonial administration instead of three. Arnold Wilson said it's going to cost you much more in the long run, and we need to have at least 300,000 troops on the ground in order to hold that territory. Those are things that I did not make up. I didn't put words into anybody's mouths. This is stuff that we're dealing with to this day.
Well, you know, before I go too much further, I want to say that Winston Churchill,
yes,
Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Yes. Lawrence, Gertrude Bell, and a lot of other people who really existed at the time are characters in your book.
Yes,
yeah.
Lord Cox and Arnold Wilson.
Yep. Yeah,
these are the people that
and
that
Detective
were
Sergeant Thompson.
I loved him. Detective Sergeant Walter Thompson.
Well, let's talk about him in a minute. There's something I want you to respond to. In Africa, it was a colonial nightmare there, and the Germans and the Spaniards and the French and the English and the Dutch and and the Italians all messed around and just took out chunks of territory. Mm-hmm. And one of the results was that, for example, like Rwanda and Burundi were cut.
Yes.
North and south, and should have been cut east and west.
Had nothing to do with tribal or ethnic or cultural.
You had Hutus and Tutsis thrown together, but it was strictly.
That's even more complicated than it sounds. Because
But it's strictly because of the way the colonial thing worked out. This is where
To me, we have the sense that we're living in the modern world and that we are sui generis. We gave birth to ourselves. And in fact, I believe that all of our international politics at this point are basically still working out a colonial and imperial past dating to the late 19th century and really screwed up after the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919.
Well, the thing about Africa is that it just happened because of the exigencies of colonialism. But in this case, a bunch of smart people sat down and screwed it up perhaps even worse than Africa on purpose.
Well, for example, one of the reasons that they thought it was a good idea to put the Kurds and the Shia and the Sunni together in Iraq was that if you had a completely unnatural and unworkable thing that you called a nation and named it Iraq, that they would never make common cause and throw the British colonialists out. That
divide
was the theory.
And conquer. Divide.
Well,
yeah.
in this case, throw them together
and conquer
and make sure that they hate one another so that they will never turn on you in triplicate and go after the and throw you out. And it worked for a long time. Iraq was a reliable source of oil for decades. So in some ways, these people did worked for them and for their empire for a reasonable amount of time. But we are still dealing with the aftermath of this. It's not even begun to unwind. As one of my characters says, yes, Faisal may be able to hold this together, but all men are mortal. And after he dies, I don't know what happens. Perhaps a very real civil war to end a very artificial nation.
And he turned out not to be the...
He wasn't the puppet they expected.
Yeah, he wasn't the
ventriloquist. Faisal
held his own.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book. Your main character is Agnes Shanklin.
Yes.
She's a Midwesterner from Ohio.
Yes, yes. After writing 1,500 pages of prose about other people's times and places, I wanted to be able to write about Ohio and Cleveland, where I know what blooms in April. I don't have to look every single fact up.
Well, and it used to be nice to live on Euclid Avenue.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is not so much anymore.
Not so much anymore, but it was a beautiful area. Yeah.
Agnes this is one of those wonderful ironies that makes life the big fat joke that it is, is that Agnes Shanklin is a spinster, 38-ish, 40-ish spinster.
Yes.
And she is freed. She is liberated by, of all things,
the great
influenza plague of 1918. Everybody in her family dies. Her mother dies. Her sister dies.
Yeah, no one inheritance is all that much, but she had $1,000 from her brother Ernest, who dies. It's soldier's insurance, and he died of the influenza on his way to France at the end of the World War I.
A not uncommon occurrence.
Not uncommon occurrence. In fact, that's all of that is every detail in this that I could manage is real. There really were that did happen to a battalion that was going over. Her brother-in-law had a life insurance policy that was supposed to benefit his wife and children should he die, but the whole family died, and so Agnes is the contingent beneficiary on that, and she has an uncle and she has a mother, and all of these things have come together, and she inherits enough money to afford her a careful independence. She can't be crazy with it, but she's always been the dutiful daughter. She is the one, the unmarried daughter who was going to help her sister raise her children, and then she was going to move in with Mama and take care of her in her old age. And now she is freed of all that, and she has this wistful freedom to go off and do whatever she pleases. And she has always wanted to visit Egypt and the Holy Land, which was a real destination in the 1920s.
People still
really
is.
Wanted to go there. Yes, exactly. So she decides she is going to take the trip of a lifetime.
Well, it's not just that. It's not merely that. Because Mama, as she calls her,
yes.
Mama is a relentless killjoy and prig.
Yes.
And
yes.
She,
Mama has kind of a mean streak.
Yeah, she does. Well, it's not just that, but was it H.L. Mencken who said that a Puritan who's someone who lives in fear that someone somewhere is having a good time?
Someone might have a good
time,
yes.
Yeah,
Mama
that's what Mama's
yeah.
like, yeah.
Yeah. And that's actually, that was interesting for me, too. When I work with a character, I always need to know what their parents were like. And so I need to know what war was happening when they were growing up. What are they reacting to? What influences are on the parents? Because that's going to have an enormous impact on how children are being raised. And for the mothers of Agnes's generation, you had a man named Dr. Holt, who was sort of the anti-Dr. Spock. He was the man who wrote the book on how to raise children, but his feeling was that maternal affection was basically a lethal weapon, that it would kill the character of any child who was subjected to it.
I wonder what his bringing up was like.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, I lived with the echoes of that because my mother was raised by someone who believed in Dr. Holt's.
Oy.
You must break their spirits. They are like horrible little animals. And if you show
them any
affection.
Well, that part's true, but... But that's supposed to be a good thing in a kid.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Mary Doria Russell. D-O-R-I-A is the middle name.
Doria, just like the ship that sank.
That's the yeah. Andrea Doria, that's right. There used to be a bad old joke, which I won't tell on the air.
Okay.
The title of the book is Dreamers of the Day, and it's published by Random House. Now, when Agnes comes into her inheritance...
Yes.
One of the things she does, even though she's got, she has Mama's voice
Mama's
in her
voice
head constantly,
right.
She runs down to Hal's department store.
Halle Berry is named
yeah.
after Hal's department
is
store.
Is that right?
That's a family name.
She came out looking a lot better than the department store.
Yes.
And she, this is, she, what year, 1920, 1921?
1920.
Yeah.
The end of 1920.
Yeah.
Yes.
So,
and it is a huge, it's a moment of enormous change. For people alive today, if you can get yourself back to this moment by trying to picture the difference between Casablanca and Edward R. Murrow and the end of the war in 45.
Oh,
and
I always make the two bookends.
A few years later, you've got Leave It to Beaver.
Mm-hmm.
The whole culture just turned on a dime. And the same thing happens. You have the end of World War I. You have the Spanish influenza, which killed 55 million people. And suddenly you've got the flappers. You've mm-hmm. got, you know, it's a big, long party for 10
years. Well, it's not just that. It's Dada and
yes.
it's surrealism.
Yes,
it's the
because
whole...
because things did not make sense. What they found out was they had this idea of here's how life ought to be, and that had the stuffings kicked out of it.
And you could be dead tomorrow, so
yes,
you might as well
exactly.
have a good time.
That was when I realized that I was beginning to get the 1920s, when I could bridge that by mm-hmm. saying, okay, now why would you get that? Why would you go from this terrible, grim period to the 1920s? And the answer is, Agnes asks in the beginning, if you knew that nothing you could do could prevent your death from this influenza, How would you react? What would you do? And she said, I'll tell you what some of us did. We boozed and screwed like there was no tomorrow. Because there wasn't.
Yeah.
You could, if you could go to work at 9 in the morning and be dead by 6 that evening from an illness that came on like a ton of bricks, yeah, you don't wait to have your fun.
You know what, though? The flapper part is a very, very small part of Agnes' personality because she's a lot smarter.
She's older.
And
she's older.
Well, it's not just that. She has a lot of character also.
Yes.
I mean, if I were to put her... You know, if I had to rate her with the women of that time, I would say Helen Keller and Eleanor Roosevelt are more in that direction.
Yes, she's a big admirer of Mrs. Roosevelt, and she will be. She will definitely vote for the Roosevelt administration. She admired Jane Addams and had initially thought that she would work in settlement work. And Mama put the kibosh on that because Mama felt that was way too down market. And wanted her to go to Oberlin and get her teaching certificate. Agnes admits it suited her. She was a very good teacher.
Wound up as a school librarian.
She winds up as a school librarian eventually. Yeah.
So she goes to Hallie's department store, and she runs into Mildred, a shop girl named Mildred.
Mildred Rosenquist is a real person.
A real person, yes.
Mildred actually did work at Hallie's department store. She really did date Bob Hope.
It's Leslie Town.
Leslie, yes.
Leslie
he
Town.
He was changing his name for a jazzier version.
Yep. Yeah. And he was had he been a boxer by then, or was he passed it by then?
He was giving dancing lessons.
Yeah, so he was
starting
past
to break into, he was breaking
vaudeville.
Into showbiz.
Yep.
Yeah, but that romance didn't go on.
But he didn't marry her.
No, he didn't. And in fact, they dated a little earlier than the period of this book, but I did use Mildred Rosenquist's name because I thought that was just a little piece of Cleveland history.
Hey, who do you think you are, James Fry?
I didn't make up anything. Yeah,
James Fry sat in that chair one time and told me about his book. But why does she decide to go to the Middle East of all places?
She wanted to when she was young. She is also a person for whom religion is important but not felt. She wants to make contact again with her sister and her brother-in-law taught at the American school in Jebel, which is north of Beirut. And that also is based on a real moment in Lawrence's life. He, in 1918, when he was an undergraduate, just starting his thesis on Crusader castles, he learned his Arabic at the American school in Jebel. I wanted some sort of connection. And when I was originally thinking about this, I began by thinking, well, maybe it will be with the teacher that he learned Arabic from. And that didn't feel new enough to me because I've worked with a lot of religious themes. I wanted something different this time. I try never to repeat myself. My next book is a Western, so go figure.
Mm-hmm. That's the connection with Lawrence. I mean, here I am sitting, I'm reading this book and I'm saying that Agnes mingles with the great and the near great.
And only by accident.
Only by accident,
only by
yes.
accident, yeah. She has...
She can hold her own pretty good, though.
She does all right, yeah, yeah. Well, she survived Mama. After that, anything is easier.
Well, you know, the thing is, she gives the point of view of the wild colonials in the United States.
And she is actually... Lawrence is kind of playing her, which is something that he was also known to do, too. I mean, people loved him, and he... But he was also capable of scoring political points. He invites her to a dinner where he has been making the argument, and it's that the Middle Eastern protectorates that have been given to Great Britain and France by the Versailles Conference, the treaty, that they should not be Britain's last brown colony. They should be Britain's first brown dominion. What Lawrence had in mind was that Palestine and Mesopotamia would have the status of like Canada and Australia.
Yeah.
A dominion is one where they have complete control over the domestic foreign policy, but their foreign policy is part of the Commonwealth. It's a joint empire.
And they make obeisance to the queen or the
king.
That's
right. Yeah. That's right. But they control all of their own internal. And I think that might have worked. It might have worked. Certainly a little better than what we ended up with. They weren't hearing him. And so he decides that if he invites a member of a former colony, he knows Agnes's politics because he knew her sister very well. And Agnes is kind of she voted for Eugene Debs, by God, in her first opportunity to vote.
1920.
That's right. And he knows that
he was in jail.
Yes, he was.
He got 900,000 votes in jail.
In jail, because he had said when we were getting ourselves into World War One, that tyranny abroad does not justify tyranny at home.
Gee whiz.
Gosh.
What an idea, huh?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's happening with this book is that some of the reviews are accusing me of making this stuff up to score political points. And I swear to God, I didn't make this stuff up.
And the problem with that is what? The problem with that is what?
Well, yeah, exactly. This is all reality. I did not put these words into people's mouths. There is a passage where Lawrence comes out of this this dinner party where Agnes has in fact made the point he was hoping, and then something very unpleasant happens at the end of the dinner, and he's infuriated. He's just infuriated. He leaves the room under control and then just detonates when he gets outside. All of what he says was published by him in a letter to the London Times. I didn't make that up. Mm-hmm. I just made dialogue out of it.
So listen, I don't know. You were probably a great student in school, but the whole thing about novels, for me anyway, is that when you research a novel, you get to learn stuff without pressure of having an exam.
I love that part.
Yeah, the research is wonderful stuff.
That's what keeps me going. And I mentioned I'm doing a Western next. I'm doing a mystery novel. It's a murder mystery set in Dodge City in 1878.
Oh, nobody ever got shot there.
With Wyatt and Doc.
Really?
Yeah. And Doc Holliday was a classically educated man who read in Greek and Latin and spoke fluent French and played piano beautifully.
And was a dentist.
And was a dentist. I used to teach in a dental school, so I get the dentistry part. Mm-hmm. But I am now, for the first time in my life, reading the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid. I'm reading them in translation. Doc read them in the original. Mm-hmm. I'm learning about 19th century piano concerti. I'm catching up on all kinds of literature that would have been known to the people, educated people of that era, that I never touched because my background is all scientific. Now reading about Wyatt and Doc, I realized that their fathers, you always have to know about the parents. Their fathers were both veterans of the Mexican War. So I need to go back at least to the Mexican War to find out what kind of political attitudes were being brought to bear in the households.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was
so
quite a time
in
the United States.
Yeah. I just eat it up.
The last piece of the continental United States was added after the Mexican War. The Gadsden Purchase, I believe. Is that what it was?
Oh, I don't remember that. I haven't gone back to that
James
far.
K. Polk?
Yeah. Right now, I'm pretty competent starting in 1848, which was when Wyatt was born, in 1851, which is when Doc was born. And so I'm getting my head around those eras, and then forward to the late 1870s.
We only got about 4 or 5 minutes left. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell people about Karl Weilbacher.
Karl Weilbacher, yes. There really was a German spy who met T.E. Lawrence when he was still Nettie Lawrence, and he was still working as an archaeologist at Karchemish. And for a long time, it's somewhat controversial, but I think people have pretty much decided that, yes, in fact, that was a legitimate archaeological site. And Lawrence did lasting work as a scientist there. At the same time, it happened to be very close to a German railway bridge. And there was a lot of photography going on. The feeling is that Lawrence was being groomed as an undercover agent. Karl Weilbacher is based on a real German spy, also Jewish, who kept tabs on T.E. Lawrence from Karchemish on through towards till after the end of World War One. And so Karl Weilbacher is a character in the book who then kind of falls in with it. He hasn't planned. This stuff isn't planned. Agnes comes and he recognizes that she is in his hotel and that she knows Lawrence. And he just asks, "How do you know her? Him? How did you meet Mr. Lawrence?" You know. And he provides Agnes with the attention and the affection that she's never gotten from any place, anybody else. And
I also love the Doc's son, Rosie.
Oh, Rosie!
Yeah,
yes.
Give us a minute on Rosie.
Okay, Rosie. Yeah. This is one of the few places where I allow myself to bleed through into my novels. I also have a 15-pound black and tan long-haired dachshund with a kinked tail, and so Rosie is a plot device She doesn't like talk or solve a murder mystery or anything like that.
Good for you.
Yeah, exactly. I have my standards. Mm-hmm. But she is closely observed from my own personal dachshund, Annie.
The dog hasn't said, hey, don't stick me in your next book, please.
No. Okay. No. There are greyhounds in the next book.
Superb.
Greyhounds.
I used to have a greyhound. Can you tell us what, there's a little bit of a gimmick to this book about the narration of this book.
Yes,
I don't know if I would, can we give it away?
Sure.
Okay.
The thing was, every writer has something that they are primarily loyal to. Sometimes it's plot, sometimes it's prose, sometimes it's market. For me, it is the characters. In this case, Agnes stepped forward and she wanted to engage directly with the reader. Well, she's 40 in 1921. Do the math. Our species doesn't live long enough for her to be able to talk to us directly without this business of speaking from beyond the grave. And you really do have, there really is a saying that if you drink from the Nile, you will return. And so that was the hook for that.
Mm-hmm. So she is narrating the book from the other side.
She says, this is certainly not the afterlife I anticipated. I expected nothing. And so she is quite amazed to find herself and does not understand how it worked, but she's coping with it the way Agnes does with everything. She copes with an Egyptian afterlife with a Midwestern school teacher's sensibilities.
And now tell us who her companions are at that bend in the river.
Well, as it turns out, Francis of Assisi, St. Francis, went to the Middle East to try to make peace with the Muslims of his time. General George McClellan. It was very interested in the Middle East and went there after the American Civil War. Napoleon, of course, was there early in his career. The other one is Cleopatra's
Ptolemy.
Brother.
Ptolemy the second
Ptolemy
or third?
One of them. Yeah. One of those Ptolemies.
That was my greyhound's name, by the way.
Oh,
Ptolemy,
all right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And he says, we were Greek. I never believed in the Egyptian gods until I got here, you know?
It
so
seems to be
they're coping with it.
Now, we don't really have time to go into this deeply, but one of the most interesting throwaways, and it's just a throwaway,
sure.
Is that it's only the gods of war that are real.
Yes. Yes, that's what Agnes is. She says that she didn't expect any afterlife at all because she has lost her faith. And she is sorry to have to tell you that she has seen no evidence of the God that her sister worshipped, except in Francis's faith. Francis does not believe in these false gods, but she sees no sign of any others. The Egyptian gods and all of the gods of war are very much in evidence in this afterlife.
I like that. That's the same way. Hopeful and cynical. I think that's I've come to expect that from you. And
yes, thank you.
Yeah.
I do my best to be hopeful and cynical.
You should come back more often. It's been 10 years. Thank you very much.
You're
I've
most
been
welcome.
Speaking with Mary Doria Russell. She's the author of Dreamers of the Day, published by Random House. We love you.
Thank you.